You're listening to Talk It Out, LGBTQ Voices in a Queer Election Year, presented by Gay City News and GayCityNews.com. I'm your host, Paul Schindler. Welcome to the 15th episode of Talk It Out. This week, I welcome back Brian Derrick, who appeared in our debut episode in May. Brian is a political strategist who co-founded Oath.Vote, a web tool that allows political contributors to maximize the impact of their dollars on the issues and causes they care most about. Brian and I talked one day ahead of this week's critical presidential debate, and we discussed the prospects and path forward, not only for the campaign of Vice President Kamala Harris, but also in the battles for control of the U.S. House and Senate, as well as in state legislative and state Supreme Court contests. He argues passionately that all of these races are important, not only in advancing progressive policy goals, but also in the more basic defense of our democracy. Brian is also persuasive in making the case that the best way to enhance the prospects for electing progressive candidates up to and including Kamala Harris may not lie in repeatedly opening up our wallets for the presidential ticket, but instead in generating enthusiasm for candidates whose names may appear well down the ballot. My guest today is Brian Derrick. Brian is a political strategist and the co-founder of Oath.Vote, a web-based tool for campaign contributors to maximize the impact of their contributions on the issues and outcomes they care most about. Brian joined me for the very first episode of this podcast back in May, and he's back to discuss his views on the state of play in the presidential race, as well as the battle for control of Congress. Brian has strong views about the importance of down-ballot races this year, including state legislative contests, state Supreme Court elections, and even local school board races. Welcome back to the podcast, Brian.
Thank you for having me on, Paul.
Brian, can you briefly outline the mission of Oath.Vote and explain how it works?
Absolutely. We created Oath very simply to help donors give more strategically in the political space. My background is as a campaign finance consultant and staffer. And in doing that work, I saw tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars going to waste every cycle because donors had really great intentions and wanted to participate, wanted to help, but just didn't know which candidates needed more money, which already had a great deal of funds, who had a clear path to victory, and who was such a long shot that it was going to be a Hail Mary. And so what we wanted to build with Oath was a tool for those donors to help target very efficiently the exact races that would impact the issues that they cared about the most.
We're going to try this morning to get to the full breadth of the races and the issues that Oath looks at. And I also want to take note for the benefit both of you, Brian, and of our listeners, that we're having this discussion on the day before the big debate between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump. That having been said, can you tell us where you see the presidential contest as of today?
I see it as the closest presidential race we've seen in at least two generations. All of the data is pointing to a essentially 50-50 like jump ball type of race. And while that might be surprising to some people, especially because they have felt the momentum shift in Vice President Kamala Harris's favor, the reality is that we're living in a very divided time where it's hard to move people and that people's opinions and preferences are not very malleable. There's like a very narrow middle. And so what the shift meant, what the momentum shift really means for the race, is that we know that the base is going to turn out. We know that Democratic voters are really enthused that we're not 2 months ago, but that puts us back into this 50-50 scenario, not a scenario where she's leading Trump by 10 points, as it might feel like sometimes in certain bubbles online.
So there's a lot of metrics that polls measure, a lot of issues that they ask about. One of the things that caught my eye in reviewing some of the recent data came out of 538. It looked at net favorability ratings. And in terms of favorable or unfavorable view, the vice president has basically an even margin at about 45% each. Former President Trump has a net favorability that is negative, negative 10, about 53% to 43%. How does that sort of measure factor into late deciders in your view?
I do think it matters. It's particularly pertinent because of the changing, the trending direction of both of those numbers, right? Is that Trump's has eroded throughout the summer as he's been more and more publicly incoherent and taken more and more extreme positions on issues related to democracy and justice reform. And like all of these pieces, when I say justice reform, I should clarify, I mean him using DOJ to prosecute his political enemies. And meanwhile, Vice President Harris has seen an uptick, a severe like swing in the opposite direction for her favorability. So I think that the trending directions matter. But I will also say that people have shown over the last 8 years a willingness to vote for Trump even when they dislike him. And so favorability isn't everything. In seeing those numbers shouldn't give us an overconfidence in her ability to win because people like her. That's specifically why people call him Teflon Don, right? Like, it's not just that he's dodging prison. It's also that for all of the things that he's done, all of the things that he's said, he just remains rock solid at this exact same level of support. And that just feels unshakable to this certain portion of the country. So in short, it matters, but I wouldn't bank on Kamala's favorability being the deciding factor in these last final weeks.
You mentioned the issue of his increased incoherence, which certainly gets a lot of buzz, I think particularly on cable news programs. For those undecided voters that may also be low information voters, are they learning about that incoherence, do you think?
I think that it has broken through more and more. Certainly, it was completely hidden from the public while Biden was in the race. When it became sort of a relative measurement, people just were saying that Biden looked older and felt older and obviously was a couple years older. And now that you remove that from the race, suddenly it is much more about Trump's capacity and whether he's going to be capable of leading 4 years from now in his 80s. But more importantly, just as we've seen sort of a decline in how sharp he is and his ability to make a consistent and compelling argument. I don't agree with almost anything that he says, but I will say in 2016, he had a clear message and he was able to communicate that message to voters in a way that neither party was doing in the years prior. That, in my opinion, is gone. And he's really resting on laurels here. Like I said, that rock solid level of support that doesn't seem to shift because people have such strong preconceived ideas about who he is. But if you look at the man who's speaking for 90 plus minutes at his rallies now, that's not the same person that came down that escalator in 2015.
Most observers are focusing on seven key swing states: Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, Georgia, North Carolina, Arizona, and Nevada. Which of those seven states or perhaps other states are you most focused on as you think about the race right now?
The clearest path to victory for Vice President Harris is in the blue wall. So winning Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, in addition to Nebraska's congressional district, give her exactly 270 electoral votes that she needs to win. But it's very it's been a very hopeful change to see the path to victory expand beyond that as well. That that's not her only option. It's her clearest option. I think it's the most likely path to 270, putting Pennsylvania as the tipping point. But she also could win with a combination of the other four states that you mentioned as well. And so while I think that the defensive move is to support the blue wall, I think the smart move is to diversify and invest in all seven of those places so that should something happen, you get a rainy election day in Pennsylvania that depresses turnout and it's decided by just a couple thousand votes, that there are other paths as well. And so I think that particularly Arizona and Nevada are also incredibly important. So keeping the path to victory as wide as we can should be the focus at this point.
There seems to be some indication that the Trump campaign may well agree with the analysis you just gave. In particular, it seems as though Trump's folks believe that if he does not win Pennsylvania, if Trump does not win Pennsylvania, it's unlikely that he can win the Electoral College. Is that how you're seeing it?
That is how I'm seeing it as well. Yes. Similar to if we pick off Georgia or North Carolina, it's probably game over for Trump. If they take Pennsylvania, like that's a very important stepping stone on his path to 270, and more importantly, depriving Vice President Harris of her path. That's why they, I think, chose J.D. Vance, one of the reasons they chose J.D. Vance, and why he in particular has been deployed to Pennsylvania so often, is they definitely see the importance there. They have scaled back. They pulled down their operations in New Hampshire and Minnesota and Virginia, which they were claiming were going to be competitive just a month ago, and are redirecting all of those resources on Pennsylvania and the Midwest.
So they see areas of Pennsylvania demographically and voter preference-wise as very similar to what the electorate in Ohio looks like.
Yeah, I think that there are parallels there. I'm from Southern Ohio, outside of Cincinnati, and I think there's strong correlation between Western Pennsylvania and Ohio. A lot of similar communities that respond to issues, to the same issues. And I think that they are banking on J.D. Vance being able to sort of drive turnout in those areas. As we've seen in the last couple of months, maybe that was a miscalculation, but I think that's the strategy.
For the benefit of our listeners, I'm reminded you mentioned the one electoral vote in Nebraska. Nebraska, like Maine, is one of two states that splits their electoral votes in the case of Nebraska based on congressional districts. The congressional district surrounding Omaha has on a number of occasions gone Democratic and provided one electoral vote that you might not otherwise be paying attention to. There are some down ballot races in a couple of these swing states. There's an abortion rights referendum in Arizona, and there's the very toxic candidacy in North Carolina of a very far right Republican gubernatorial candidate, the current Lieutenant Governor of that state, Mark Robinson. How do those kinds of factors play into your expectations about the outcome of the presidential race?
In complex ways, because not only are the various levels of turnout for those races going to impact who is there to vote for the top of the ticket. So, for example, you might have someone in Arizona who's really angry about the abortion ban there, shows up to vote to overturn that ban. And while they're there, they also might vote for Kamala Harris, even if they weren't going to show up to vote for her without that ballot measure. And so it changes the electorate, certainly, but it also has its own independent, I think that it also has its own independent impact on the electoral landscape in all of these states, where you have a situation where in North Carolina, should Mark Robinson be elected, we're going to see a really intense swing to the right, rubber stamping the most extreme policies on reproductive rights and LGBT equality and voting access and all of these things that will impact all of us, because it will determine whether North Carolina is competitive at all in 2028, or whether we are restricting access to the ballot so much that it takes it out of play. There are many races that will affect gerrymandering. For example, in Ohio, there's a ballot measure that could ban gerrymandering in the state, which would allow Ohio to send a representative delegation to Congress, which again impacts all of us because we all are affected by who controls Congress. And so, yes, these races will have an immediate impact on what the electorate looks like at the top of the ticket, but it will also have a lasting impact on the health of our democracy and the direction of policy in these places for tens and tens of millions, hundreds of millions of Americans.
How should voters think about the blizzard of polls that we're seeing almost every day? A new major poll comes out looking at the swing states, looking at the national average and so forth. How are we supposed to digest all of this information?
Well, polls are really tools for campaigns. And these days, they are clickbait for the media. And it's not helpful to read every poll and understand the crosstabs and who's up, who's down every day. It will drive you insane, but it's not actually helping anyone unless you do something with that knowledge. What the polling is telling us, whether it has Harris up today by one or Trump up tomorrow by two, what it's telling us is it's extremely close. It's going to come down to tens of thousands of votes across a handful of states, like we mentioned, and that we have the power to determine who those votes go to by donating and phone banking and knocking on doors and showing up and posting online and talking to your friends, that we actually have the power to influence that, that this isn't about predicting the weather, right? Like, this is about steering a ship, and we still are standing at the wheel. So polls are only as useful as they are in motivating you to take action to change the outcome. And that's the important thing to remember. If you're just sitting at home, refreshing 538, talking to no one and doing nothing, you're not actually civically engaged. You're not actually participating in democracy. You might as well be watching The West Wing. And so my caveat on polls is always that it's a call to action, not a passive consumption that makes them powerful.
And Oath.Vote has consistently emphasized, first of all, that the importance of all this information is as a tool for action. And you've also consistently emphasized that the full range of races that you look at are important, because we need to think not only in terms of what happens in November, but what our democracy is going to look like in 2026, 2028, and beyond. Your site has flagged election officials who are election deniers. At this point in time, are there specific states or localities where such deniers are currently in office and you fear could threaten the integrity of the outcome?
There are dozens of Republicans who are knowingly spreading disinformation and misinformation about the 2020 election and already the 2024 election, who are in office and inherently, like by definition, are eroding the core institutions of our democracy, our free and fair elections, trust in our ability as a country to elect our own leaders. I will say that I believe in our ability to conduct a free and fair election in 2024 and to have a peaceful transfer of power, probably and hopefully from Joe Biden to Kamala Harris. I believe in that. I am concerned about those individuals, and there's already election litigation underway. Like, this is going to happen. It's not an if Republicans try to undermine the outcome. They are already doing that. There are already over 80 cases filed trying to restrict who will be permitted to vote and which ballots are going to be counted. And so this is an ongoing fight already. But I do not believe they will be successful in their efforts to overturn the outcome should Vice President Harris win. The state that I'm most concerned about, to your actual question, is probably Pennsylvania, unfortunately. And that's because current Pennsylvania law does not allow them to begin counting votes until after polls close on Election Day, processing those votes, which takes, as we saw in 2020, days to do. Democrats, who control the Pennsylvania House of Representatives, put forth multiple bills, multiple solutions to get Pennsylvania in line with other states and do that process faster, to process and count the ballots in a methodical and a transparent way, but to do that faster to get a result. Because it's that window of time that would-be autocrats like Donald Trump take advantage of to try to cast doubt on the election. Trump tried to claim victory when he should not have in 2020. And so that is the period of time that makes me the most nervous. Republicans rejected every one of those solutions. Every bill failed to put forward any of their own alternatives. And therefore, we are again going to have to wait likely days for the Pennsylvania results in 2024. And we already know this. And there's nothing to be done about it anymore because Republicans sat on their hands knowing that it would cause this uncertainty. And so that is the state that I'm most concerned about. Even if we ultimately get to the correct outcome and an accurate vote count and declaration, I'm concerned about the number of people who will lose trust in the process during, and the number of conspiracy theories that will spread about, I'm using air quotes here, but like ballot dumps and all of the made up things that happened in 2020. But this time, I would say we're primed for even more of that in 2024.
So Pennsylvania Republicans blocked the counting of mail-in ballots before or by Election Day. And then we could see Trump out there saying, oh, do you remember the days when all the votes were counted on Election Day? What's going on in Philadelphia?
Exactly. It's highly contradictory to say that you want results on election night and at the same time be preventing the processing or counting of those ballots before Election Day, that you're trying to, in many states and many places, demand hand counting of ballots, which we know is slower and less accurate. And so they're creating a situation which adds delays and uncertainty, and then taking advantage of that uncertainty and those delays to cast doubt on the outcome that they do not agree with or do not like. And so, yeah, we are setting ourselves up for another very stressful week in November. Again, this is all contingent upon the election being as close as we think that it will be.
Kamala Harris raised almost three times as much money in August as former President Trump. Do you believe her campaign is positioned to raise all the money that she could reasonably need?
I do, without a doubt. She's set, and she's broken and set records and then broken those records and set new ones. As I said before, the Democratic base is as energized as ever. We're now at the same level as like 2007, 2008 level of enthusiasm, far outpacing where Republicans are in terms of their support for Donald Trump. And that has translated to financial resources. We know that the Democratic base of grassroots donors far outnumbers the Republican base of Republican grassroots donors. And that's enabled her to raise a incredible amount of money very, very quickly. And there are millions more donors who will continue to support her no matter what we say on this podcast. And so, or for me on my Instagram. And so my message to people is very much, if you want your dollars to count, you have to look somewhere else. You should be looking at these other races and at other candidates who can really use the funds. And that might be the determining factor in their election result.
In terms of your conversations with people who are very concerned about November, how hard is it to make the argument to them in ways that they can feel in their gut that despite the anxiety they have about the outcome of the presidential race, that they should really be looking to other races. How tough a sell is that?
People are more and more receptive to it because we have seen firsthand the results of ignoring those races. When we win the 2020 presidential contest and then see Roe versus Wade overturned and abortion bans pass in a record number of states and all of these book bans and open carry laws and these things that nobody's asking for, that nobody wants, it is because we fell asleep on all of these down ballot races for decades. And so it's very easy for people, when you make the connection, to understand that if they want to see a pushback against these laws that they hate to see, that are giving them anxiety every time they get a New York Times push notification, that you have to invest in state legislatures, in gubernatorial races, in state Supreme Courts, that those are the bodies making the decisions that have made the last 2 years feel like we're under attack, even when we're in control of the White House. And more Democrats are understanding that and wanting to engage, but they need a strategic way to do that when it's a very overwhelming process. And that's why we created Oath.
Earlier this summer, I was interested to see you write about nonprofits that are the most effective around the country in driving voter turnout. Can you talk about that assessment and what groups are you currently advising folks to take a look at?
Yeah, they're all nonprofits are by definition nonpartisan as required by law. But if you have an organization that focuses on registering people to vote and focuses on registering young people, for example, as their mission, which is perfectly acceptable under the law, that work is going to have a partisan effect, right? That, like, we know that young people skew Democratic, and so registering an extra million young people is probably going to result in additional votes up and down ballot for Democrats. And so we do make some recommendations to donors who are looking to fund that type of work and that ongoing civic engagement work as to where they can do that really effectively. Two of them would be Voter Participation Center and Freedom to Vote, both doing really excellent data-driven work around identifying unregistered voters and getting them registered in the most strategic and cost-efficient way possible, whether that's mail or text messages or in-person canvassing. It's not a replacement for partisan activity, right? You cannot get the election outcomes that you want by just supporting nonprofit organizations, but it is a good complement to the other work that these candidates and campaigns are doing.
And can folks contribute to those groups through Oath?
Absolutely. Yes, we have those and many other organizations available on Oath as well.
In May, we reviewed the state of play in Senate and House races around the country. What is your take on who the most threatened Senate Democratic incumbents are?
So we are defending the seven closest races in the U.S. Senate. It's a really tough map for Democrats to cycle. You have to remember that only a third of the Senate is up every 2 years. And so this is just our toughest ABC type map. I would say the person who's most vulnerable at this moment is John Tester in Montana. Polling is showing a really tough race there, either him slightly behind or tied. That does not mean that people should run and send as much money as they can to that race. He and Sherrod Brown in Ohio have raised the most money of anyone running for U.S. Senate, like $50+ million. And your $10 or $100 or even $1,000 is unlikely to change the outcome there. But I do think that that's the one that we have to be most concerned about losing and therefore giving up the majority to Republicans in the U.S. Senate.
The open seat in Maryland is being described as a lean Democratic seat by the Cook Report. Maryland, of course, is a very Democratic state, but the popular Republican former governor Larry Hogan is contesting that seat. Do you agree with the assessment that that seat is likely to go Democratic in any event to Angela Alsobrooks? Brooks?
I think they're making a strong case in Maryland that electing Hogan gives Republicans control of the Senate and therefore the ability to confirm more extremist and anti-abortion judges, the ability to block tax policy that will benefit middle-class people and instead pass tax breaks for the super rich and corporations, that it doesn't matter what he says he supports, that it matters whether Republicans are in control of the Senate. And by electing him, you will give them control of the U.S. Senate. And I think that they're making a strong case in Maryland. And that gives me confidence that she will ultimately win that race.
So that argument is outpacing Hogan's argument that he's a moderate and an independent Republican, which is backed up by his years as governor. But you're saying that the argument about control of the Senate seems to be winning the day.
I believe so. Based on what I've seen, yeah, I think that voters are smart. And it's kind of a Trojan horse type argument to say, well, I'm not going to support that, but I will be the vote that puts the people in charge who do support that. So, yeah, I like her odds.
In terms of the House of Representatives, where are you looking most closely in terms of the Democrats flipping the House? And how confident are you that they can do that?
I think that we have a lot of work to do to flip the House first and foremost, but we have a clear path to doing so if we show up for these races across the country. There are about 24 toss-ups right now. We need to win 15 of them in order to flip the House. That would be a net 4-seat gain for Dems. But a majority of the districts that Biden won in 2020, but still elected a Republican member of Congress in 2022, are in California and New York. And so those are the races that will likely determine chamber control. And they're not the battleground states. It's not in Pennsylvania and Michigan and Arizona. It's not where people are thinking about when they think about competitive races. And it's another reminder that your vote matters everywhere. Your vote matters no matter where you live. There are competitive races happening everywhere. And so even if you're in New York City, even if you're in LA or something, it matters that you turn out and vote and get engaged and help these elections, because it might be your neighbor down the street deciding who controls Congress next year.
A couple of these races are actually in the greater New York City area. Mondaire Jones challenging Mike Lawler in New York 17. Josh Riley going up again against Mark Molinaro in New York 19. I noticed that Mondaire Jones is on your list of top House races to contribute to. How do you see Mondaire's chances this fall?
Yeah, it's going to be a really close race. This is Sean Patrick Maloney's old district, and it could be one of the handful of seats we've identified as being most likely the tipping point seat, that 218th seat that you need. And I'm thrilled that it's as close as it is to New York. I will be going up there on the train to knock on doors and talk to voters. And we're, of course, donating and trying to support however we can. But it's certainly going to be a close one. And I think potentially an uphill battle as of now.
So we talked already about the fact that Oath emphasizes the importance of down ballot races and control of state legislatures and states in which voters choose their state Supreme Courts are key focuses of your site. What state legislative control situations are you most focused on?
There are 13 chambers that are in play to flip one way or the other. And that means like hundreds of seats that we're watching. We make it really easy to figure out which ones are the most important on Oath. But in particular, I would highlight the Pennsylvania House. Maintaining control there where we have a one-seat majority is critical to preventing an anti-abortion ballot measure in the state of Pennsylvania. Holding on to the Michigan House and the Minnesota Senate, those trifectas have been some of the most legislatively productive in recent memory. And so rewarding Democrats for passing common sense things is a good idea there. In Arizona, we have the opportunity to flip both the House and Senate, potentially giving Democrats a trifecta in Arizona and completely transforming the landscape in that critical state. And then there's other states that might not be on people's radar. In New Hampshire, the legislature could flip. We could break supermajorities in North Carolina and Kansas. And the list goes on. There's so many critical races. 5,800 state legislative seats are up in 2024. And so making sure you're educated about who's going to appear on your ballot and the races where you can have the biggest impact is a really easy way to get involved in 2024 in a way that will be meaningful when it comes election time.
I spoke to folks out in Wisconsin, and they were very excited about the prospect of flipping the House in Wisconsin. And with recent redistricting there of flipping the Senate, not necessarily this year, but in the next election cycle. Is that assessment one you agree with?
Absolutely. Yeah, we're watching Wisconsin really closely. We could be, because of the redistricting, we could be flipping up to like 12 or 15 seats in the assembly, which is amazing. And it would be very impactful to have some legislative sway and control in that state, moving Wisconsin more along the path of like a Minnesota. So definitely that should be top of people's lists as well.
And talk a bit about the state Supreme Court races. Where are they happening and what are the most important ones to look at?
Yeah, there are 82 state Supreme Court seats up this year, but there are only a couple of states where the majority is in play, where whoever wins in November could take control of the court ideologically. And so in Michigan, the majority is in play. In North Carolina, we need to hold on to a seat to hopefully flip it next cycle. In Montana, there are nonpartisan races, but the ideological tilt of the court is definitely at stake, which is important for things like reproductive rights there. And then there are also retention elections happening where it's not a Democrat versus a Republican, but it's deciding whether we want to keep a specific member of the court on the bench. And those are happening in Arizona, where that court had ruled to enforce the 1864 abortion ban. And I think that a lot of angry Arizonans are ready for a new court that sees the world a little differently. And so I think that those will be important to watch, as well as some of the court races in Texas.
I spoke to people in Ohio who were concerned about the impact that the state Supreme Court could have on the recent abortion rights referendum there and also on the legalization of marijuana. Is the Ohio state Supreme Court something you're looking at as well?
Definitely. It's Michael Donnelly, Lisa Forbes, and Melody Stewart all running in Ohio for state Supreme Court. Really important races that have been overlooked for a long time. And that would give us the ability to flip the court. And as you said, it would affect reproductive rights in the state. It would affect the potentially how this gerrymandering ballot measure goes and is enforced or not, as well as a lot of other issues affecting democracy. So those are really important races.
The last thing I want to ask you about, Brian, is what you refer to as reverse coattails. I have been talking about it as up ballot impact, but I think we're talking about the same thing. And I noticed that if you go to the Oath site and enter that your biggest concern is protecting democracy, which I think most people are thinking about protecting democracy by voting for Kamala Harris. But I noticed that in that category, your top races are all state legislative races. Talk about the way that works and what the impact of reverse coattails are.
Yeah, the idea of reverse coattails is that funding down ballot races can actually benefit the top of the ticket, where if I send $100 to Kamala Harris's campaign right now, I know that there's like an 83% certainty that $100 is going to be spent on TV ads and media buys, and that's not the most effective way to turn out additional votes. But when you have as much money as the presidential campaign does, it's one of the only ways that you can spend it. And when you give to a down ballot race, let's take, for example, a state legislative campaign, we know that there's a greater than 50% chance that it's going to be spent on staff. And that means more people knocking on doors, going to community events, getting local press, some of the most effective ways to spend money to generate additional votes. And that when you turn out that Democrat who's voting because the local hospital is closing or because of the traffic problem in the town, rather than these nationalized issues, that person also is likely going to vote for Kamala Harris over Donald Trump as well. And so that is how reverse coattails can turn your dollars into votes more effectively at the top of the ticket than simply throwing more money at Vice President Harris. In terms of our protecting democracy strategy, it changes. There are multiple components because there are multiple threats to our democracy right now. You already highlighted that we're working to keep election deniers out of office, particularly offices overseeing our elections. So that's oftentimes highlighted under the Protecting Democracy tag on our site. State Supreme Courts also highlighted regularly because they make decisions about voting rights and election litigation, which is going to be an issue in 2024. And as you noted, right now, there are state legislative races there. And those are in states where election certification is potentially an issue, right? There were multiple states where state legislators were ready to throw out the ballots of millions of people. We have to make sure that they do not have the power to do that in 2024, particularly in states that seat their new legislators before the certification process is over. And then also ensuring that we have forward progress for things like voting rights and just like the basic tenets of a healthy democracy that allow for participation, free speech, and not the sort of anti-democratic agenda of the far right.
I think that the concept of reverse coattails kind of turns conventional wisdom on its head. I think people would tend to say, gee, if you don't care about who the president is, why would you care about who your state legislator is? And what I hear you saying is that money into, let's say, a state legislative race is another entry point into reaching a voter. Am I understanding that correctly?
That's exactly right. We know that a state legislative campaign looks and sounds a lot different than the presidential. The issues that Kamala Harris is talking about are different than the issues that someone running for the Arizona State House might be talking about. Again, they might be far more localized. It's about the policies in that town and what they want to pass in the state house. And that's going to reach different voters than the voters who are motivated by Kamala Harris's economic plan and her fight for reproductive rights and all of the contrast between her and Donald Trump. And at a time when our national politics are difficult to watch oftentimes, right? That it's like very negative and very toxic, or has been for years. I think we're seeing that change right now. But when it's a big turnoff for a lot of people, that's another way to reach someone in a more direct, more relatable way. And yeah, if you're voting for Democrats at the state legislative level, I think there are very few people who are ticket splitting with Donald Trump at the top of the ticket.
To learn more about Brian's work, you can go to oath.vote. That's OATH.VOTE. And you can also follow Brian on Instagram, Brian Derrick, co-founder of Oath.Vote. Thanks so much for joining the podcast again.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks again to Brian Derrick for joining me a second time on this podcast. And thanks to all of you for joining me again this week. Next week, on September 18th, we'll once again visit Florida, a state not generally talked about this year as a presidential swing state. It is, however, a state where reproductive rights are on the ballot in the wake of a stringent 6-week abortion ban enacted earlier this year. Floridians will also vote this November on whether to return Senator Rick Scott for a second term. Scott has been considered the favorite in this year's race, and he previously served two terms as governor, yet he has never won statewide by more than 1%. So don't count out former Democratic U.S. Representative Debbie Mukersell Powell in the November contest. Last month, I spoke with LGBTQ community leader Nadine Smith, the executive director of Equality Florida, and she argued that Florida is more competitive than pundits assume, a position her group reiterated just this week in a press release declaring that the state is in play. So I'm revisiting Florida next week, speaking to two other progressive groups there, Progress Florida and Florida Watch. If you have not done so already, please subscribe now to Talk It Out, LGBTQ Voices in a Queer Election Year on Apple, Spotify, and other podcast platforms.